ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
She is a global TV phenomenon and an unlikely one, the mighty Mary Beard. Hi, Natasha Mitchell with Big Ideas. Yep, you might have seen her blockbuster TV series on the ABC and BBC as she gallivants across Europe on a bike with that long grey mane of hair and very sensible shoes. Now, the thing about Mary is she knows how to tell a bloody good story. And she makes the Roman Empire absolutely riveting, like a salacious soap opera, and it all started for her as a kid.
I went to the British Museum when I was five with my mum. And then I wasn't particularly keen on the Greeks and Romans. I was keen on the Egyptians because, you know, mummies and things like that. But my mum said we ought to go and look at the Egyptian Everyday Life Gallery in the BM because we should not just think about the dead, we should think about how they lived. We went into the gallery, and this is in 1960, and the British Museum certainly wasn't child-friendly then. And the cases were all very high. At the back of one case, my mum said, "Hey, look, there's a piece of 3,000-year-old Egyptian cake there." And I thought, wow, I want to see that, but it was... I couldn't see it. She got a load of bags. She tried to lift me up. I tried to peer over. It was impossible. I couldn't see the bloody cake. At that moment, a guy walks past who must have been a curator. And he says, "Was I wanting to see anything in particular?" And I said, "Yeah, that piece of cake, you know, in the back." He gets the keys out of his pocket. He opens the case. He lifts the cake out and he puts it in front of my eyes. And that was just mind-blowing, you know. And it was mind-blowing then because I saw the cake. And I think that as I've rethought about it and obviously, you know, slightly reinterpreted it as things have gone by, time has gone by, I think he gave me a very important message about opening cases and making things accessible and opening things up for kids who want to know. And that's what he did for me.
Don't we all have a moment like that from childhood trips to the museum? Or growing up trips, yes. Dame Mary Beard, she's the celebrity historian, a British national treasure, and also ready to wage debates with social media trolls about all manner of historical fact and fiction. If you follow her on X, formerly Twitter, you know that about her, and it gets her into trouble sometimes. This Professor Emerita at Cambridge University has cut a path through a male-dominated field to bring history to the masses in her unique way. She's author of over 20 books, including her latest, Emperor of Rome. So let's join Mary at Adelaide Writers Week for this wonderful conversation with the Australian writer, documentary producer and former head of arts at the BBC, Jonty Claypole.
I want to start, Mary, just by talking about your method. And you talk in both the conclusion of SPQR, An Emperor of Rome, which is in some ways a sequel to that book, about your approach to classicism being a conversation with the Roman people rather than a history of Rome. And I've latched onto that because that idea of conversation over instruction seems so intrinsic to everything you do, how you write, how you broadcast, how you speak to people. So I want to build out from here and ask you, what's the difference between conversation and history, between learning from and engaging with?
Well, I think I used to not have a conversation with the Romans. I think that when I was a student, I was taught to see history as somewhere out there, rather buried. And then what my job was, if I was to be a good historian, was somehow to get rid of all the crap, get rid of the rubbish, and try to see what was left of the Romans. And then, as it were, describe it and explain it. And it was a rather kind of limited sense, I think, of explanation, because we were explaining largely what posh old white men did, not what the others did. But it really was, it was a kind of process of revealing the past, which was sort of there, and we just had to find it. I mean, I suppose I don't want to be over modest. I think I was quite good at doing that. At least I, you know, did well in the exams that tested that. But I always found it, or I came increasingly to find it, sort of a rather weird procedure, actually, partly because it tended to leave an awful lot of things out. It also tended really to efface the historian themselves. I mean, the historian was not supposed to be visible in this story. They were supposed to be the person who did the hard work and then presented the history. And yet, I kind of knew that that wasn't what was going on, and that what I was doing, I was talking to the Romans. I was, you know, indeed, I was doing something rather more complicated. I was ventriloquizing the Romans and talking to them, because the Romans didn't exist. You know, the Romans are long dead. 2,000 years ago, we can do what we like with them. They're not there to complain. And what I wanted to do, or what I found myself doing, was conducting, in a sense, what was a partly imaginary conversation, which enabled me to put myself in there, to recognise how weird sometimes the Romans were, to have a bit of a joke sometimes at their expense, but as it were, to think about this as a process of conversational discovery. And that helped me look for slaves, it helped me look for women, it helped me look for all the people that didn't actually emerge if all you tried to do was sort of find what was left. So I came increasingly to see it as something that I was engaged with, and that although I didn't want to sort of, I didn't want to take over the Romans, I didn't want to make them in my image, and I wanted to be responsible in that conversation, nevertheless, there was a bit of me in that, and it sort of mattered to me. I mean, when I was a student, I don't think the Romans mattered to me very much. They were there for me to reveal and analyse and then move on to something else. I think they matter to me a lot more now, because I think I'm engaging with them.
Yes.
Is that what you wanted to know?
Well, it was what I wanted to know. I don't know about... What was the world of classics like? You know, Cambridge, late 70s. You sort of hinted at it there, but set the scene for us. What was this world that you, Mary Beard, a young Mary Beard, were going into in the late 70s?
It was very weird. It was very weird. I was the first person in my family to get a degree. So, you know, I didn't have loads of relations who kind of told me what uni was like. I was finding it out for myself. And one way of saying it is it was Cambridge in the mid-70s. It was very blokish, very white and very posh, right? At that time in Cambridge, there were about 10% of the students were women, probably fewer reading Latin and Greek. And women were kind of cherished, sort of a cherished, and they were cherished, minority. And you felt that it was a man's world, and you felt that the way you succeeded in that world was trying your best to pretend to be a man, right? I think that was, you know, can you outman the men, right? You know, again, this is sounding terribly immodest. I was quite good at pretending to be a man. It just didn't feel quite right. It was helped, I have to say, because Cambridge has a complicated structure. And so the university and the Faculty of Classics was very male, and it went on being male. For a long time, I was the only, when I got a job there, I was the only woman lecturer, and there was 26 guys and me. But Cambridge is divided into colleges, and I was at an all-women's college. And so I was living a double life, in a way. I was living the life of, you know, a woman in a man's world. But my college, where I had a lot of my teaching, where a lot of my friends were, that was women only. And I think that's what saved me, in a way, because it gave me a sense that I wasn't an entire freak. And then it also gave me a sense that there was a place where you could, you know, talk about women's things, and where you weren't just completely outnumbered. And so I lived a world of women only, but with part of me, and part of it was a very small minority activity that I was doing. Now, I should say, because it tends to sound as if you're moaning, when you talk about being in a huge minority, it's not something that you think is desirable. It's changed now, not totally, but it's changed a lot. I didn't have a rotten time. And to be honest, I have to thank some of those old posh white men who really looked out for me. And I was extremely pleased to have a women's community, but I got looked after by some of the people who I now tend slightly to ridicule. So I want to say, you know, many of my friends, going back a long way, are those guys who, in a sense, dominated my world.
In that shift from history to conversation that we've been talking about, how important was feminism and feminism in the 1970s as a movement to you in that shift?
I think it put iron in my soul. You know, my mum was an old-fashioned socialist feminist, basically, and she was a fighter, and I think, along with my dad, she brought me up to think that, well, not even to question the idea that women could do whatever they wanted to do. You know, I didn't think that was an issue. I thought that was how, you know, I thought that's what I was going to be able to do. It wasn't really till I got to Cambridge that I discovered there were people in the world who didn't think men were as good as women. Now, I'd probably been a bit naive before that, and I probably hadn't noticed. But it seemed to me as if I could do what I wanted to do. I remember, you know, when I was at Cambridge in my first year, I still remember one very vivid example of something I hadn't come across before. I had a friend, male friend, round to my room. My room was a terrible mess, kind of my essays and stuff are all on the floor. And this guy said, I'm going to tidy up a bit, right? And so I thought, oh, fine. Picked up one of my essays that I'd had marked by my teacher. And at the bottom, the teacher had written, oh, this is a very good essay. This would certainly get a first-class mark in the exam. And he picked this up and said, you get a first, right? And I thought, the only reason that you're saying that is because I'm a woman.
At least he was tidying up for you.
He was, I happen to say, he was tidying up. And I also have to say, he went on to be a very distinguished ballet critic, and we are still the best of friends. And I've never confessed to him that this story is about him. Because I suspect he doesn't remember, but I do, yeah.
So there's Mary Beard, who's the academic in the 1980s and co-authoring articles and books with men. Then, for me, you sort of emerge fully formed in the early noughties as the Mary Beard I know. And I know you resist the idea of epiphanies and the idea of big moments of transformation, but there must have been significant turning moments for you in that change.
Yeah, there were. I mean, but it took a damn long time, you know. As I said, I was a good student. I was sufficiently obedient to get a good mark and to go on and do a PhD. My PhD is colossally boring. I'll tell you its title and then you'll see it's colossally boring. It is called The State Religion in the Late Roman Republic, a study based on the works of Cicero. And I think every word in that title says boring, right? And, you know, I suppose if I was standing outside myself, I would say I was pretty. There was a kind of girlish element in this. I wanted to please. I wanted to do well. I wanted to get a first. I wanted to finish my thesis, get a job. And I did all those things. I think that, you know, many women in the academy and in other jobs would say this, and it sounds very familiar. It was a question in part of trying to pretend to be a man. I mean, I found, for example, when I first started to lecture, I kind of copied the men, right? And so I kind of stood up and I did it okay, but somehow it was like I was acting, right? And I also felt that I wasn't speaking for I wasn't speaking for myself. And I did have a real turning point, which took a very long time to come to any fruition, but I now look back to as being hugely important. It was when I was a very young academic. I'd just got my first job and I'd written an article. I wanted it to be published in a journal and I wanted it to kind of be part of my CV. I had a male friend who was much higher up the ladder, and I said to him, would he read this article before I submitted it? And I said, and I want you to be absolutely frank, and I want you to tell me, you know, whether it's any good, what's the matter with it? Now, because when anybody gives somebody else their piece of work and says, I want you to be absolutely frank, that is not what they mean. You know, what they mean is, I want you to tell me it's brilliant, right? But you're not allowed to say that. So he would say, tell me anything. We used to meet in the British Museum when the British Library was there in the old round reading room, and we would go out and we'd have lunch at Pizza Express. So we went to Pizza Express to talk about the article once he'd read it. We had one bottle of wine and he then said, well, I think we should have another. That was obviously a sign that things were going to go a bit odd. We talked about my article for a bit and he pointed to some things, and as we were finishing the second bottle of wine, he said, do you know, Mary, I think this is all right. It's right. But do you know, it's boring. When you're 25, you've got your first job, but you've just written this article and it's cost you blood. The last thing you wanted to know is that what you'd written was boring. I put a brave face on it. And I'm sure that it took him a lot of energy and courage to tell me that, you know? It didn't feel like that at the time, but I think that's why we had two bottles of wine, not one. But I went home and I thought, I don't want to be boring, you know? That's one thing I don't want to be. I don't mind being wrong. I don't mind being irritating, but I don't want to be boring. And it took me another decade and a half to learn how not to be, actually. And part of that was about going to this process of conversation. Yeah. It was actually saying, there's got to be me in there. You know, I'm allowed to make jokes. I'm allowed to say, this doesn't add up to me. I'm allowed to say, weren't the Romans weird? And I think it started, the kind of transformation for me started in lecturing, not on paper. You know, when instead of saying, well, ladies and gentlemen, I have three points I want to make this morning, etc., I'd say, you know, I could start and say, I want to start with a statue that always makes me absolutely split my sides. I think the Romans are so stupid when I see that. And they'd all look up and say, God, what's she going to talk about? So I got in to investing a bit of me in this, I think. And I then got into investing a bit of me in writing too. And I felt, what I ended up feeling was that Mary was speaking here. I didn't feel that I was pretending to be someone else or I was aping anybody. This was a long time before I even got near telly. But I think it's something which has carried over to being on telly, because although I don't often watch myself and, you know, I need another bottle of red wine if I'm going to sit down in front of the telly to look at myself. But when I do, I see myself. Right? I sometimes think it's not very good. I sometimes think it's pretty smart. I don't judge it. I judge it very differently. But at least I know it's me. And that for me has just been the breakthrough, really. Yeah. You know, whether that goes for politics and, you know, running the academy and all this kind of stuff. You know, actually, I think I'm going to say what I want to say, and it's going to, when I listen to myself, it's going to sound like me.
Yeah. The other sort of turning point I feel that I saw in your career was, there was a moment as well, we talk about you as being a classicist, but there was a moment where we were hearing you talking about things which aren't ostensibly about the classics. And I think for me, that was around 9/11, 20 years ago.
not my finest hour, 9/11, I have to say.
You've sort of expanded and you're a classicist, but you've also become what we in old-fashioned terms call a public intellectual. And we'll talk about immigration or politics. And is that a role that you sought out, or was it something that came to you?
It's a horrible word, isn't it? Public intellectual. I mean, you know, as if you were to go to a party and someone were to say, "And what do you do?" You'd say, "I'm a public intellectual."
Yes.
You know, that would be the end of the conversation, wouldn't it? You know, you can say I'm a classicist. Fine, public intellectual. That's a real no-no. Look, I think I've learned it a bit from doing the ancient world and looking at Greece and Rome. I think it's about citizenship, actually. I think that, you know, what is it to be a citizen? It is to talk and contribute and to share your views, which might be wrong. I don't think that because I'm a classicist, I've got any better views than anybody else. But I think that I've got something different to contribute. And with all modesty, I think that we ought to be speaking up. We don't want, you know, do we want politics only to be the business of people who call themselves politicians? No, we don't. Isn't that partly the problem with politics? Yes, it is. We want citizens to be engaged, sometimes to be wrong, sometimes to be persuasive, and to give what they've got. And, you know, I think it goes back a bit to my mum's old-fashioned socialism and the fact that, you know, I was very lucky and I got my education at university free and I got a grant and I was paid for by the taxpayer. And I was always told, well, you've got a duty to give back. Mm. And one of the ways of giving back is to comment. I get a lot of, you know, flack on what used to be called Twitter for this, you know. I mean, people say Mary Beard should stick to classics, right? Now, I think that's pretty gendered. They don't say Simon Sharma should stick to history when he talks about things. They say Mary Beard should stick to classics. Poor dear, you know, get back in your burrow. But, you know, I think that we all ought to be talking about this and offering what we've got. And I, you know, as Jonty hinted, you know, some of my contributions have been less than good. But you have to live with that, you know. People say stupid things sometimes. And we probably live in a culture where people aren't allowed to say stupid things, where I'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt, you know. People make mistakes. Right? And I've made, I mean, at least my fair share.
I wasn't trying to prompt an apology or anything. I was.
I think I would say that when you say things that you believe that produce a hugely adverse reaction, the very least that you have to accept is that you didn't say it right. You know, you might have been wrong, but you didn't get everything right. If people start attacking you, probably you're not right.
I'm always struck by your bravery in your willingness to speak about things and through social media. You know, you have to deal with a lot of trolls. What? How do you cope? Like, I wouldn't be able to cope with... I'd be hiding under a duvet if I was Mary Beard. So how do you... Has it just been a process of toughening up over the... Like, how do you process it?
It's a bit... I mean, I think that when I first went onto social media any big way, what I had been told and what I did was, as soon as somebody was nasty about me, I blocked them. Right? And people said, don't reply, don't give them the oxygen of publicity, just block them and move on. Now, I saw the logic of that, and I don't think that anybody really should tell anybody else how to deal with social media. I think you've got to find your own way. But I started to feel terribly frustrated. You know, I thought, these guys are talking crap. And what I'm doing is just moving on, right? If I went into a bar late at night and I heard blokes say that to me, saying, you know, good, you know, your face looks like a cabbage, right? You know, I'd say, excuse me, you know, it's me you're talking to. And I'd go to the barman and I'd say, those guys have been awful. So, but on Twitter, I'm supposed to just take it. It's like leaving the bullies in charge of the playground. So I started to write back. I didn't always do it very well, but I started to say, sorry, I don't agree. You know, and did you really mean that about me? Perhaps you'd like to rethink. Sometimes, now I mustn't exaggerate here. I don't have a very high hit rate of success, yeah. But I have one sufficiently large to make it worth going on doing that. And I came to the conclusion, I think, on social media, that there are some people out there who are very, very nasty, right? And they are sitting there and they are wanting to attack women, they are appalling misogynists, they have political views that one can only speculate about. But they're not many. I mean, most of the people who look nasty on Twitter, X, you know, most of them are probably a bit pissed. They're sad. It's late at night. They haven't got anywhere to go. And they take it out on you. Right? Now, I think the West has a problem if I were to say that, look, that male anxiety tends to take the form of misogyny. I think that is a problem. But I don't think these are necessarily all of them nasty people. And quite often, you know, they're sad, lonely people who, when you reply, they turn into pussycats, you know? I can't remember what the guy's crime was, but I remember once I wrote back and said, look, do read what I wrote again, because I don't think that I said that. He writes back and says, oh, I never thought you'd reply. And then in a series of tweets, one of those awful kind of sets of tweets, he told me his life story. He said, look, the thing is, I'm a retired policeman and I've just had a heart bypass operation. And I am feeling a bit low, and I'm sorry if I took it out on you. I'm really keen on history. And in fact, I live in Glasgow, and we meet at our local pub every Tuesday night to talk about history. If you're ever in Glasgow on a Tuesday night, do come by. And you think, that was a really nice encounter, you know?
And did you?
I have to say, I didn't. But I thanked him warmly and, you know, look, I don't think there's anybody in the world who's been on Twitter with any regularity who has not made some kind of error, right? Said something they didn't want to. And again, it's a bit like making mistakes. You know, I can't forgive those people who sit there and target very nastily people like me. But when people say things, you know, that they perhaps didn't mean, my job, I'm now retired, my job was teaching largely late adolescents between 18 and 21. And if I'd kind of taken the line that they weren't ever allowed to make a mistake, I'd have got very pissed off with my own teaching. So, you know, just be a bit generous. A bit generous is what I want to be.
Befriending the Haters is the unconventional classicist Mary Beard. And on Big Ideas on ABC RN and ABC Listen, Natasha Mitchell joining you in the front row seats for this wonderful conversation at the Adelaide Writers Week between Mary and Jonty Claypole, who was the former head of arts at the BBC, an Australian. In fact, we've heard about Mary's journey to becoming who she is, the world's most famous classicist, an outspoken public intellectual, a breaker of glass ceilings, a prolific user of social media. Well, in this next half, the conversation turns to Rome and empire, the subject of her latest book.
Your new book is Emperor of Rome, Ruling the Ancient Roman World. In some ways, it's a sequel to SPQR. It's a wonderful book and a wonderful read, so I'm highly endorsing it for everyone to buy a copy. The thing that struck me most about it is that I feel the Beard Project so far has been a sort of bottoms-up approach to history, if that's an acceptable term, that it's meet the Romans with Mary Beard. You've always come at the classical world through trying to understand what ordinary people were doing. And you've claimed in the past that it can hardly have mattered who was on the throne. So why a book on the emperors? Is this a return to great man theory of history?
You're not the first to suggest that, Jonty. But let me say emphatically not, right? There's two things about the emperor that I think, my book, The Emperor, that I think puts it into context. The first is, and it sounds a paradox, but it's true, is that you actually can get to know the ordinary person in Rome almost better than in any other way through the eyes of the emperor. Now, why you can do that is because part of the role of the Roman emperor is a bit mythicized, but part of how they were supposed to be is that they were supposed to be accessible to everybody. Right? And there's a wonderful story about the Emperor Hadrian, who's riding through the countryside. An old peasant woman comes up to him and says, "Excuse me, Emperor, I've got a question for you." And Hadrian turns around and says, "Terribly sorry, too busy." Right? And she says, "If you're too busy for me, you're too busy to be emperor." Right? And he stops and he deals with her problem. That kind of sums up, it was a kind of Roman cliche almost, that sums up the idea that the emperor is the man, it's always men, to whom you go in the last resort with your problems. Now, it so happens that in different forms, whether it's written on papyri in Roman Egypt or inscribed in stone, we have a very large number of the complaints, the begging letters that were sent to the Roman emperor from ordinary people throughout the Roman world. So you do start through his eyes, through what ended up in his in-tray in the imperial palace, you start to see what ordinary people were bothered about. And it takes you right down to what looks to us, not to the people concerned, really trivial incidents. I think one of my favourite comes from the Roman town of Cnidos, which is on the coast of modern Turkey. And it's a disputed legal case which ends up hundreds of miles away being dealt with by the Emperor Augustus. And it details what's gone on. You suddenly get this vista of nightlife in the Roman town of Cnidos. And it turns out that there were two kind of rival families. And their rivalry began to express itself in sort of nighttime brawling. And one lot used to come round and sort of besiege the house of the other lot. And they got pissed off, basically. So when this happened after several nights, the people in the house said to one of their slaves, "Go up to the upper floor and empty the contents of the chamber pot under the heads of those beneath, right? That'll send them away." The slave does this, but he also drops the chamber pot, which kills one of the guys underneath. And so there's a homicide case against the owners of the slave. And the local authorities are going to actually find that family, husband and wife, guilty of homicide. They then go all the way to Rome, to the emperor. They put their case before the Emperor Augustus, and he decides that it was justifiable self-defense. And they're so pleased that they inscribe this in minute detail and put it up in their town, right? Say, "We got let, you know, the emperor said this was okay." Now, that's one very nice example, but it's repeated hundreds of times over. You hear about, oh, the people who live near the Roman barracks and the squaddies are always coming in and trashing the town. You hear about lost cows. You hear about men who tried to prostitute their wives. You know, all of Roman life is there. And so you think that if you're going to work on the emperor, you think you really are going to be with the upper echelons, and there's a bit of that. But what's fun for me is seeing what these guys actually dealt with. And it's quite interesting because you think, blimey, it must have been a tough job. Yeah. You know? I mean, forget all that stuff about sex in the swimming pool. It was doing the filing, I think.
And you say in the book that they are governing the entire empire a lot of the time, and they're getting messages from governors saying, what should we do about this? But somehow there's something in the system where the emperor is single-handedly, apparently, governing this vast empire before the telephone.
Yeah, or email, right? Basically, you've got the emails from provincial governors, what would now go by email, sometimes preserved. Now, you've got to be realistic. There was a lot of staff. And one of the things we can do is find out something about those staff. But the buck stopped with the emperor. And I think, and this is the other kind of side to what you're talking about, Jonty, I'm not too bothered really about which emperor I'm dealing with. We get terribly fixated on the apparent individuality of these emperors. There was, you know, the wise Augustus, the hypocritical Tiberius, the barking mad Caligula, the doddery old Claudius, etc., etc. Now, I think it's very hard to characterise them. No doubt they were a bit different, but they were much more similar than they were different. And they all did the same job in the same place, with the same facilities, with the same staff, eating the same kind of meals, the hundreds of years of the Roman emperor. And so I don't want people to get remotely frightened when they pick up this book and it says, you know, she deals with emperors from Julius Caesar for the next 250 years. And you think, oh, blimey, I've got to know whether Antoninus Pius comes before or after Hadrian. Well, you don't, you know, sometimes I forget. And I'm trying to say it doesn't matter very much because what I'm writing is a sort of job description of the Roman emperor. And they, some of them saw it like that too. And there's a great quote from Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius, I have to say, is still a best-selling author who tends to outsell Mary Beard on Amazon even now.
That's why you don't like him.
That's why.
Well, I was wondering why in the book you're so dismissive of his Meditations. I didn't realise it was jealousy.
Jealousy, yes. Well, I feel ambivalent. I don't know whether I should feel very pleased that this old Roman, sadly, so long dead he can't take the royalties, is, you know, still way outselling us, or whether I feel a bit pissed off. But amongst his Meditations, which I don't much like, and these are the kind of best-selling self-help manual of our time, he looks back as his predecessors, and he basically says, look, Roman emperors, those come before me, same play, different cast. And in a sense, that's the motto for the book. You don't actually need to know. Most people in the Roman Empire talked about the emperor. And as I've said before, they probably didn't know who he was. Right? Yippee!
Is there anything you... and don't worry, if you, for those who haven't read the book, you get all the gory stories.
Oh, yes,
so, but I mean, do you think there's anything... Could you take a sort of scorched earth approach to Suetonius and you say, we can't know anything? But do you then, privately, do you think actually... I kind of know the emperor I'd be more comfortable in a room with. Like, do you have any... If you had to choose to have a sort of private audience with an emperor, surely you would choose somebody. I know this is a very un-Mary Beard question.
It's a very, very un-Mary Beard. I will answer it. I will. But just before I answer it, I want to say in prequel, as you said, look, I just like everybody else, I love all the anecdotes about Roman emperors that aren't true. I love them. You know, Tiberius up to no good in the swimming pool, Nero being so keen on his acting that he locked people up in the theatre so they couldn't escape. You know, and some women actually gave birth while Nero was performing, right? Or my favourite emperor, Elagabalus, who invented the whoopee cushion. He was only 14. So it makes more sense if he's a teenager. He used to put his guests to eat on inflatable cushions, and during the dinner, he would have the cushions deflated so they ended up on the floor, right? And he also, because he was so generous, he poured rose petals over them from the roof of the dining room, but he was so generous that they smothered and died, right? No, I think all these are both untrue, but extremely interesting. You know, just like our celebrity gossip is untrue, but tells us quite a lot about modern culture. I think, you know, the idea of you have to be aware that an emperor's generosity can kill you is a very important message. So who would I meet? Well, part of me says, well, it doesn't matter, does it really? I'll meet any one of them. I think having just name-checked Elagabalus, who also had such modern habits, like this is the Imelda Marcos story, he never wore the same pair of shoes twice, right? I think I would choose to meet this Syrian teenager who ruled for 4 years and had four wives in the period. Find out. But I'd rather. See, this is where I go back to what you said, Jonty. You know, I'd much rather spend an evening with the girl who mopped out the baths when everybody had gone home. She'd have much more interesting stories to tell.
And we should make it clear for posterity that if anyone needs to give birth, they are entirely welcome.
It's good. You're lucky, you know.
You can leave.
There's no barbed wire fence. Men used to, the men couldn't pull the pregnancy trick, so they used to pretend to be dead, and then they got carried out. So it was said.
Right? I'm not spoiling anything, but because you mentioned this at the start, but you end the book by coming back to this theme of conversation over history, over instruction. But you add something in new, and I was very struck because you separate the Mary Beard of social media. I always talk about you in the third person, even when we're together. You always separate the Mary Beard of social media with the history books and the classics books, and you don't bring your own sort of views outside of the classics into them. But you end the book by giving quite a personal statement about autocracy. And I can feel when you're writing it, it's been a big decision to bring that in. And I want to ask you why and what you understand by autocracy and what it is you're warning us about.
Yeah, I was partly pushed to come clean about what I thought about the imperial regime by our publishers, who said, come on, you've written this book. So, you know, what have you learned? What have we learned from reading it? And when that question was posed, I did see different coordinates in the Roman Empire and in how Roman power worked. I think it would be very easy to imagine that the Roman Emperor ruled by the sword, that opposition was fiercely put down, and it was a brutal military dictatorship. Now, I think in some ways, in our terms, it was, but probably only as much as all of Rome was brutal and military. You know, murder was basically the ultimate solution to anybody's problem, right? In the end, you kill the enemy, you don't negotiate. And so I'm not in any way trying to suggest that it was a nice place, you know, that we would enjoy living close to the centre of power. But I thought, look, actually, the Roman Emperor isn't kept in power by brutality, only to a very small extent. He's kept in power for hundreds of years. I mean, because individual emperors get murdered, but the system lasts for hundreds of years. He is kept in power because people collaborate with him. He is kept in power because the Roman people went along with it. Right? We like to think that we're looking for the opposition in Rome. There is no opposition that we can see to one-man rule in Rome after the early first century CE. You know, these guys, they probably muttered about emperors, they muttered about the unfairness of autocracy. They analyze it quite well, but they don't oppose it. The Roman people and the elite, as much as anybody else, they would say cooperators, we might say collaborators. And I thought, that's the message, isn't it? I remember once asking a group of students, about 20 students, what do you think you'd have done if you'd been living in France under Nazi occupation? And every one of them put their hands up and said, I'd have been in the resistance. And he thought, no, sunshine, you know? That is not what would have happened. One of you might have been, most of you would have been going along with it. And I think that does have a bit of a message for us now. I mean, I think there is a sense that democracy is slightly fragile, or more than slightly fragile in more than one part of the world. If we want to save it, we can't be like the Romans. If we want to save it, we've got to speak up for it. Because when autocracy comes, we are likely to go by the Roman example and the example of every other autocracy, we are likely to be collaborators. So let's shout about it now before it's too late.
Thank you, Mary. I'm going to go to questions for... So if you want to ask a question...
And I hope there'll be some questions because I've come ever such a long way to be here.
Hi. I'm glad you say that, Mary. Thank you. Because this is a question to you as a trustee of the British Museum. To Greeks all over the world, the Parthenon marbles are of immense cultural and spiritual significance. On Desert Island Discs, you said that you would like to take some of the marbles with you.
I did
to
say,
your desert island, so I know that you love them too.
For a very short... I said I'd give them back instantly. I just wanted them on a very temporary basis.
Well, that gives me hope. So, you've stated that you remain agnostic in regard to the return of the Parthenon marbles to Greece and that you see both sides. Are you able to comment, then, on the British Museum's current position on their return? And you've also stated that you can't see them remaining there indefinitely. And so are you able to advocate or prosecute for their return, especially in this particularly hopeful moment in history in which it is becoming standard ethical practice for cultural institutions all around the world to decolonise their collections? Now...
Can we wrap up with a question?
Getting to the question.
I think we've got the question.
Greeks, no, we grew up listening to our parents lament their loss during the Ottoman occupation, and now we're grandparents. So where do you stand, and will you help us get them back?
I stand in a lot of places, and I've had a long time to stand in different places. I still think it's a very complicated issue. I think the whole issue of cultural restitution is a complicated one, not a simple one. That said, in general, I don't imagine that when I'm long dead, let's say 50 years' time, I won't be here to see it. I do not imagine that some of these contested objects will still be in their contested places. I think objects will move. I'm not going to give you a prediction about the Parthenon marbles, except, as I think you know, if you keep your ear close to the ground, there are rumbles, and we are hoping that we can at least reach a solution which is better than what we currently have. Now, I can't possibly say, I don't know what that's going to be. But I think that, well, if I was a politician, I'd say, I'm very optimistic that if you just wait a bit, you might find that things are going to change. But I have no further comment because it's too early to say, right? Okay.
Thank you. Let's go to the next question, please. And thank you very much for that question.
Do you think lay people should learn Latin? Can they benefit in any way?
Oh. Yeah. I mean, I think it's great fun. I think, I mean, I'm not a kind of Stalinist on Latin. There are some people in the UK who think that every benighted child should be made to learn Latin. I don't think that every benighted child should be made to learn almost anything, really. What I want is for people to have the opportunity to learn Latin, not because, although it does this, it kind of trains your mind or helps you with other languages, but there are things that are really worth reading in Latin that you get more out of if you read in the original. Now, most of us also read in translation. You can get an awful lot out of Roman and Greek literature in translation. There's something special about reading it in the original language. And I would like, and I hope I've done my bit in this, I would like to try to make sure that the opportunity to learn Latin is much more widely shared than it currently is. And particularly in the UK, I don't know what it is like here, but in the UK, you know, I want people to be able to learn Latin not only if they're rich.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming to Adelaide. We really appreciate seeing you. Come back again. My question is related to what you just said before we went to questions about how we should speak out before it's too late. I was wondering, were there times during the long period of the Roman Empire where they could have perhaps done that?
I think that their answer to that would be no. The last moment when there is any evidence that they thought that things might change is at the death of Caligula in the early first century CE. Caligula has been assassinated. Claudius is about to come to the throne. And they do hold a meeting of the Senate, which they start to think, could we do it differently? And a guy gets up and he gives a rousing speech in favour of restoring the Republic, going back to some form of democracy. And it all sounds great. There are two reasons why that doesn't happen. One is, actually, it's too little too late, and Claudius is already emperor, actually, so the moment's gone. His peers in the Senate look at him and they look at his signet ring and they say that they see that on his signet ring he has a portrait head of the Emperor Caligula on his ring and they think, collaborator. So that story is told as a story of their realisation that the game for the Republic is up. And we have no evidence, that doesn't mean that it never happened, we have no evidence for an attempt to change the regime ever after. Even when you get periods of civil war, what they're fighting about is who's going to be emperor. They're not fighting about a more general regime change. So, I mean, it is a rather bleak history in that way. And most of the historians, the Roman historians who write about it, when they look at the individual bits of opposition, which are opposition not to the system, but to individual emperors, they kind of think of these guys as just, you know, hopelessly naive dissidents, but with no plan, you know? The assassination of Julius Caesar, you know, Brutus and Cassius had no plan. Right, and so it's a bleak prospect, I have to say.
Thank you.
That's why we should be particularly aware. Once we lose it, we might not ever get it back.
You get the sense we could learn a lot from the machinations of the Roman Empire, hey? In some ways, things haven't changed all that much. Human nature, certainly one of them. She's a dame, a professor emerita at Cambridge University, and an author of over 20 books, including her latest, Emperor of Rome. You heard from historian and classicist Mary Beard speaking with Jonty Claypole at Adelaide Writers' Week. Natasha Mitchell rounding off this edition of Big Ideas. Now, if you want to hear more, just head to Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app and you can share this episode from there to spread a bit of Mary Beard love with your friends and family. Thanks for your company today. Great to have your ears. I'll catch you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.